07-3593, Alan Bilthouse against the United States. Mr. Fleischer.
Thank you. The issue here is whether the district court properly granted summary judgment on the basis the court found as a matter of law that the SEC stock became worthless in 1995, not 1997. Thus, we were not entitled to refunds. All of this is because of this whole controversy is because of the U.S. Supreme Court case in Gitlitz, which said that a sub-S taxpayer, when there's cancellation of indebtedness, does not get income. It increases the basis of the stock, and they can deduct previously suspended losses even though they didn't receive income. And the Supreme Court said that's what Congress says, that's the law. Congress has amended it since then, but that was the law at the time. So we stated that in 1997 there was cancellation of indebtedness that increased our basis. That's when the company became worthless, and we could recognize previously suspended passive losses. The court said that the company became worthless in 1995. We both agree, I think, that the case law that we have says that in order for it to be worthless, there has to be no liquidation value and there has to be a loss of potential value, that there's no hope or expectation it could ever become profitable. And the Seventh Circuit in the Morton case said usually this is a question of fact. We think that to say it's 95 is a matter of law, this company had no hope of becoming profitable and the stock was worthless at that point in time is wrong. In 1995, the company had $38 million in receipts, had hundreds of employees. The company had a new president who had just come in the late 1995, Mr. Akers, in order to do a turnaround, and the company had a lawsuit because of this large problem with City of Jacksonville. The bonding companies, who were independent people in 1995, came into the situation and said, we want the company to finish up the jobs with City of Jacksonville. We don't want to liquidate the assets, which they could have done. We want the plug not to be pulled. We want the company allow the company to go into private jobs. No liquidation of assets, no ending of employees, allowed us to bring in new work at that time. There was a lawsuit filed. Now, I think that there was an ongoing bank loan. Barnett Bank had an ongoing relationship with the company in 2005 where they were loaning the company money, 1995 through 1997. The big problem I think the district court has, the district court said it's up to the court to look at this Jacksonville lawsuit and determine whether the lawsuit had any reasonable hope of creating profitability for the company. And we say that it's really not up in this case to the district court to review that case and override the decision that was made by everybody who was involved. Mr. Evers and Mr. Akers gave affidavits that in 1995 that they thought that the company could be turned around, that they were continuing on business, they were looking for new business. Those affidavits are in the appendix and record, and they believe the company could turn to profitability. One of the keys in the case is that page 26 of the government brief, the government says that we never substantiated the amounts that we could recover in that lawsuit. But we had argued at page 6 of our brief, we had said to the court, look at the record at record 49, exhibit 45. That's Evers' deposition, the president of our company. Mr. Evers was asked by the government attorneys, how do you know how much the could be recovered? They had an exhibit that they went over at page 134 of that deposition that they went over, and the government attorneys asked Mr. Evers, who came up with these damages? Evers said Safeco, the insurance company, went out and got an outside consultant who developed this, and the outside consultant said that the damages to be recovered were, not a wild guess, but $20,448,594.48.
The original contract for the project was only $12 million.
And that was the problem, was that there was a contract that had a $12 million price on it. There were cost overruns that the insurance companies, certainly my client, but the insurance companies also felt that Jacksonville was responsible for this huge loss that occurred because of the various cost overruns, and that they had a basis to file this lawsuit to recover this $20 million, because that was a big loss that caused this company to have this major problem at the time.
Sir, how do you answer the government's suggestion to us that you really haven't shown that that lawsuit about the landfill had any real chances of succeeding? I mean, it just simply, objectively speaking, the lawsuit itself had no value. It had no possibility of really reaping a return. That you never really put anything in this record to establish that.
The way I show that, Judge, is that the government says that in 1995 that this company was worthless. That's what the court found. Now, we say that suit had a value. The simple answer is you've got two bonding companies that deal with real estate issues. Those bonding companies, not my client who's a passive investor, but those bonding companies said, you know what? We don't want to liquidate this company. We want to keep the company in business, and we're going to pay to file this lawsuit, and we're going to make a claim for this $20 million, and we're going to pay attorneys to pursue that lawsuit. Now, if you have that, and you have these independent people, not my client, but the people who deal with construction damages and completion of projects saying, there's a lawsuit here that we think we can recover on, you don't have hopelessness. You don't have worthlessness. At that moment, there's a case, and it's really not up to the district court to say, well, I think Safeco is wrong.
Were there any other investors or any other commercial entities that stayed with the company throughout that period, 1995 to 97?
We had additional business. We also had a bank, remember, Barnett Bank, who continued to loan us money during 95 to 97. It wasn't until 1997 that the Barnett Bank loan ended. 95 to 97, the company, the record shows clearly that the bonding companies allowed a certain amount of money to go to the company so this new president, Akers, could try to bring in new business. Now, There was an issue at this point in time because until we resolved issues with the bonding company in this lawsuit, the bonding companies weren't going to give us new bonds for public improvements. And in 1997, when the bonding companies said, you know what, we're deciding now that we're going to dismiss this lawsuit and sell all the assets, get rid of the employees, and liquidate the company, at that moment, the company became worthless.
Go ahead.
This is back to the lawsuit now, and I know your position that, you know, they said, you know, we're going to pay the lawyers, we're going to pursue this lawsuit. People have a lot of motivations for filing lawsuit, and is there any deposition testimony of any of the bonding company people or the bank people where they make reference to any facts that would show there was a real triable issue in this case?
Well, the damages were, as I say, if you look at Exhibit 45 in the record at 49 at pages, I believe it starts at 127, there was an actual exhibit that listed all the damages, and the government questioned the parties about the damages. As far as the theory of it, some of those damages were just cost overruns, others were consequential damages, and they had different types of damages. But
But to me there's a difference in adding up what you think of the damages and saying what the potential damages are and whether or not you think you can win on them or you can prevail or you have a legal theory that will support the damages.
There's nothing.
So that's what I'm trying to get to, what's in the deposition that shows that.
The record here does not show the counts to the complaint. All we can say on the record is that outside people, not my client, not the management of the company, said, we're not going to liquidate this company. We're not going to end this company. We believe the lawsuit and the potential business is enough that we're going to hold off. We're going to let you keep operating. We're going to let you keep going. Obviously, machinery and equipment.
So then we have to make our judgment based on their personal view of the situation.
I think that
if you think that's a good standard for us to apply.
I do, because I don't think the district judge is correct in stating that I'm going to say that I'm going to put myself, you have to take a snapshot in 1995. We don't know how much it would cost to complete the projects because they haven't been completed yet. All we know is that in 1995, that there's a lawsuit there, there's employees, there's an ongoing business that's running, and it's really an incredibly difficult decision to say that this is worthless. This company has no hope of becoming profitable because of one lawsuit, one case that put it into this situation. With that lawsuit, it gave hope until 97. And that's when Barnett Bank said, we're going to cut off our loan, which is an ongoing loan. So we've got all these people, including the new president, who was hired to turn around the company.
Mr. Fleischer, I'll have to ask you to end at this point. Thank you very much. We'll hear now from Mr. Hutter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Randolph Hutter for the United States. The issue before this Court, to put it briefly, is the potential value of S&E stock in 1995. It's basically been decided and conceded that it had no liquidating value left in 1995. As the District Court correctly held, the taxpayers did not present sufficient evidence on this issue to withstand a motion for summary judgment.
The absence of liquidated value in and of itself, however, would not be sufficient. Is that correct?
That alone would not establish worthlessness of the stock. That's correct. The stock could have some potential value even if it had no liquidating value, so both factors are important. The evidence in the record shows that S&E became insolvent in 1995. Mr. Ebbers admitted that in deposition testimony. And that year, it turned to its bonding companies to complete the contracts. The record also shows that in 1995, S&E reported on its income tax return $18 million in losses. And beginning in 1995, S&E stopped doing bonded work. Bonded work was the heart of S&E's company, S&E's work.
If I may interrupt at that point, sir. You make that point emphatically in your brief. The other side answers and says, but there were efforts to transform the business of the company to non-bonded work during that period of time, and that the company, in fact, did try to pursue private construction contracts at that time. As long as that was a good faith effort, as long as there was some viability to that attempted transformation, why wasn't that enough to say that the end really hadn't come?
Well, I would not say that. I don't think that they characterized anything as a transformation. They said that they had this other business, SCI, going and doing private contracts. I think it's particularly telling that after we responded in our brief, they in their reply brief don't mention SCI anymore. It's to me, I think that we answered their issues completely. They don't show that SCI was intended to be a continuing company. Akers testified that in 1995 they were beginning to eliminate SCI, their private business, altogether. And he was downsizing the company and working it as a downsized company. They weren't growing. They weren't continuing. And another factor is that they didn't show in any way the percentage of their business that was this residential business, and they didn't even allege that this residential business itself could keep the company going. They had a huge amount, millions, over $25 million in debt, and they got rid of their residential business. They stopped qualifying for funding for bonded projects, and they continued to complete the projects that were in process in 1995. They didn't take on new bonded work, and SCI was eliminated as a company. Akers said that would happen.
Well, what about, you know, counsel takes a strong, argues that, you know, because the two presidents believed that S&E had a future, that there was potential value in the stock.
Their argument for potential value hinges completely on this lawsuit. The Ebbers and Akers, both the past presidents, both testified that it was this lawsuit, and they've admitted in their brief that if without a cash infusion from this lawsuit, S&E could not continue. So that is the crux of it. It hinges on that completely. It doesn't hinge on how the banks were treating the company or other business they were doing. They've admitted without a cash infusion from this lawsuit, the company was dead. And what they could have done to show that in the district court, I think, is what's important. They could have introduced the complaint, and the district court could have seen the allegations regarding what was at stake, what was the way they calculated their damages? They said the complaint was worth $15 to $27 million in damages, but Evers only testified, well, those claims were based on consultants' opinions. Put the consultants' opinions in the record. Do something concrete to say, rather than someone who has a self-serving, subjective interest who brought the lawsuit to say that my lawsuit was worth $15 to $27 million, we need some objective evidence. The district court could have analyzed the complaint. The district court could have looked at consultants' opinions regarding that and seen whether the court thought the claims had any value and had the value that they said that they did. Another thing they didn't put in the record was how much SNE needed to get out of its debt. They didn't even allege a value in this record for, we need $20 million and we'll pay off all of our creditors and we'll be back on the road. We need $15 million. We need 30. There's no such argument. There's no such evidence. Put in an accountant's balance sheet.
Well, how did the district judge evaluate the value of the company?
A value of what, sir?
Evaluate what the company was worth. How did the district judge do?
The district judge in this case, I don't think she did. There were balance sheets on the S&E tax returns, and I've cited the part of that in my brief. On those balance sheets, the S&E reported that it had 25 million, something like that, on that scale, in excess of its assets. The district court did not do an independent analysis of how much the company was worth, and I don't think that the taxpayers put that in the record at all. I cannot find in my brief where I put the tax return information. There we go, page 26, footnote 7. Balance sheets on tax returns filed by S&E show that the company's accounts payable increased from almost $23 million in 1995 to over $26 million in 1996, while assets decreased from $10.2 million to $5.97 million in the same period. That's as close as we have to understanding what the level of S&E's debt was, what kind of money it would need to recoup in order to recover. And in order to recover and have a reasonable, it had to show that it had not just some glimmer of hope of continuing business, but that it had a reasonable hope of continuing in business. It needed to show the basis for its hope, and it needed to prove to the judge in the district court that its hope was reasonable. And to do that, they had to present concrete, objective evidence, not just the opinion of Ebers and Akers saying, we thought that this was a viable lawsuit, we thought that these claims were justified. That cannot withstand summary judgment, because that is not sufficiently probative evidence to show that you have a genuine issue of material fact. They're conclusory allegations and claims instead.
Mr. Hutter, if I may.
Yes, Your Honor.
Looking at the cases that have been decided under this section, summary judgment, there seems to be a far more definitive event that makes it clear that things are over than we have here.
Yes, Your Honor.
How could we square this case with our previous case law and sustain the judgment of the district court?
Well, that's true. There is no definitive event, but I think that this case presents a situation where you don't necessarily need such a definitive event. I have to put it in the terms of the taxpayers brought the suit, and the taxpayers claimed it happened in 1997. We come in and we disprove that. Now, that's different from coming in and establishing that a particular event established the worthlessness. We simply came in and said, your proof isn't adequate, and in 1995 you became insolvent, you stopped doing bonded work. All the evidence points to the fact that you became worthless in 1995.
The district judge then, my earlier question was, did not make a determination of the value, just said they didn't support.
Exactly. The district court's task was to say, okay, here I've got 1997. Have you shown based on what, in considering the United States argument and their evidence, have you shown that potential value for this corporation did in fact continue until 1997 when certain definitive acts occurred? And our position is no, they didn't show that, and I think the district court did that correctly. So you are not deciding in necessarily when the stock became worthless and what the definitive acts were. The court below decided, well, it simply didn't happen in 1997 because you haven't shown that you lasted past 1995.
So I think in answer to the questions of my colleagues, you probably, I think I know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway. How is a taxpayer supposed to know when he can write off a passive investment when there is no identifiable transaction signaling that the taxpayer's stock is worthless?
Well, usually you do have a particular, a more concrete evidence of worthlessness. And you also have a full disposition of the stock, something that you would consider the end. I no longer act as a stockholder. The taxpayer is generally going to know. I think that in some circumstances like this, it may be arguable. We may end up in court again over this issue with a different party. And the United States, I'm not saying the United States couldn't lose on this issue in some case where the taxpayer says, look, it was all over by this point. Don't wait until 1997 when my company went bankrupt. I'm saying it went belly up in 95. I'm reversing the facts, of course, because everything fell apart then, and it had nothing to go, and they were running on fumes for two more years. I think that would be a hard argument to make, but not impossible. And the usual definitive events that mark such worthlessness are not present here in 1995, but the district court did not have the evidence it needed to support that the worthlessness occurred in 1997. And, of course, as we mentioned in our brief, we had other arguments that the district court never got to, that a disposition didn't occur, and that the forgiveness of indebtedness was the amount that the taxpayers claimed that it was. We definitely dispute those amounts, and should this court for some reason find that worthlessness was not the proper issue here, and it should go back. More findings need to be made for this to be completed.
Thank you, Mr. Hart.
If you have no other questions, thank you.
How much time does Mr. Fleischer have? Well, Mr. Fleischer, I'll give you about 2 minutes in case you've got something you'd like to say in rebuttal.
Just very briefly, Your Honor. 97 is when the identifiable events took place. If the taxpayer had said in 95 the company was worthless when we were doing $38 million worth of business, had ongoing equipment, taking on new jobs, there's no possible way we could have said the company is worthless under the potential value test. As the court asked, all the district court said is you had all these accounts payables. That has nothing to do with the value of the stock or the potential value or the potential of the company. This record shows that the big creditors were the two bonding companies. At any point in time that we could have worked something out with the two creditors and the two bonding companies, at any point in time we could have gotten one large job, we had potential value. There's no reason to say that this company was worthless in 1995. To hand a copy of a complaint to a judge and say, look at the complaint and now make a determination from the complaint, that's not going to help at all. And I would again state, in contrast to counsel, if you look at that testimony that I talked about before, that list of damages, if you looked at what I cited before, R49, Exhibit 45, they went through the damages. There's an exhibit dated June 9th, 1996, that Safeco's outside consultant developed his damage theory. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fleischer. Well, Mr. Fleischer, Mr. Hunter, the court thanks both of you for very fine briefs in this case and for a very fine oral argument today, too. The case will be taken under advisement.